were doing when he was screening first armored division in the Gazala area.
Well, if you can get the Gazala line, you know, that runs about 50 miles, say,
yes,
and it's one mass of minefields. The Germans on one side, and we're on this side. And behind that, our lines, we've got a number of defensive boxes with different brigade groups in them. Okay? And the layout, as I recorded it, was the 1st South African Division with tanks of the Royal Tank Regiment under command. They were up in the north. And to the south of them were the 50th Northumbrian Division, the support of 42nd and 44th Tank Brigade, or Tank Regiment rather, not Tank Brigade. And in the centre were the Guards Brigade in a box, defensive box. And to the south were the Free French. And on their operational order, which I've got a copy, it said to be held to the last man in the last round, the Free French.
Abir Hakim.
Yeah. And behind this force was 7th Motor Brigade, infantry and anti-tank guns. In the centre and to the rear were the 2nd Armoured Brigade, 22nd Armoured Brigade, and 4th Light Armoured Brigade. A total of about 600 tanks. Some of them were the American Grants with a 75mm on, but the remainder, about 450 of them, only had the 2-pound or the 37mm. So it was with the Panzers sort of having the greater number and the greater firepower, which has always existed, I think.
We were consistently outgunned.
We were. And that was the sort of lineup in, and of course the armoured brigades were the 1st Armoured Division. Which,
and it was then you were screening?
Yeah, well, we were sent up on different jobs after that. We weren't actually screening them, we were up closer to the front line, actually.
What sort of jobs were you doing?
I think I'll come on to that as I. To our rear on the Mediterranean, across the Tobruk, which was manned by the 2nd South African Division. And on the opposite side of the minefield were the Afrika Corps, with 15 Panzer and 21st Panzer Division and 90 Light. They were the cream of the Germans, and a great number of Italian divisions. And they were just waiting to jump forward. C Squadron were in the area of Knightsbridge, and then the 22nd Armoured Brigade were in that area. And the Brigadier commanding was Brigadier Billy Carr, who had been a 12th Lancer. I remember him as a squadron leader.
Did you have close contact with them?
Well, I did, because the Brigadier used my armoured car to travel around all the positions on the 22nd of May. And all over the place, I had to drive, or I didn't drive, but I took him when the battle started.
So you were acting as his personal transport?
For a while,
yes.
Yeah.
For how long? Just for one day?
Oh, no, for a few days.
A few days. What did he tend to do then, during those days? How did he spend his time?
Well, he'd have a staff captain or somebody with him,
yeah,
in a jeep or whatever,
right,
you know, and they would always follow our armoured car. And we'd go all around the different brigades, or where they'd been fighting, or where, and I would sort of be commanding the vehicle, and he'd have to tell me, you know, who he wanted to see, and I'd have to get the map reference and take him to those particular places.
How long did that take him to get round on his visits?
Well, we'd go out for a day, and we'd go to different different areas which he was interested in. I mean, and he might stay in one place for an hour or longer, depend on how many places he wants to see, or he might just want to get a general look at the area, which was, or where the minefields or whatever. Whatever he wanted to do, I used to just take him.
Was he just going within his own brigade area, or was he going beyond?
Oh, I think occasionally he might have gone into his next, you know, side or one of the other divisions or what. I think it depended on what he the agent was, you know. But as I say, we wandered all over the place. I wasn't quite sure where we were going or who we were going to see. What, you know, whether it was a brigade HQ, division headquarters, or a regiment headquarters, or what. It's just that we'd turn up at a place, and that would be it, you know.
Did he visit anything below regimental level? Did he go down to squadron or company level?
Oh, he went up to the front. He went up to see where the tanks had been destroyed and all that sort of thing. Yeah, he just sort of wandered around the front line and then come back for his own headquarters.
What sort of size and scale was his own headquarters?
Oh, well, all these people sort of used to have a tack headquarters and then their main headquarters, and they spent as much time away from their main headquarters, I think, as they possibly could, going out with their tech headquarters, still keeping in touch. And in this case, the Jeep was the one they kept in touch with, back to his own headquarters.
So what would be his tech HQ? It
would be my armoured car,
yes,
and a couple of vehicles.
When you were travelling around, did you say he was in the Jeep and you were...
No, he was in my armoured car.
He was in your armoured car.
I was on the back.
And you were sitting on the back of the car?
Yeah.
Directing it?
Yeah.
And then who would be in his Jeep? His staff captain?
His staff captain, and I don't know who they were. Might have been brigade major, although I think the brigade major would have been back at the main spot. I think a couple of liaison officers or intelligence officer and that. It'd be about three people and the driver would be in the Jeep.
Maybe in the armoured car.
Following on close behind, you know, they'd sort of be within shouting distance.
It seems to be most likely that the brigade major would be back minding the
headquarters
while he was
while out. He was out, and he could always pass a message or get something back from to the Jeep. And then that'd be shouted up, or we'd pull over and they'd come up and talk to him.
When you were going around on these trips, did you ever get beyond your own front line into what might have been enemy territory?
No. Of course, we had the minefields,
yes,
to stop us, and the infantry
in the boxes
and things like that. We went round some of the boxes and things like that.
And you mentioned earlier that you had a chance to look at the boxes on this occasion. I mean, what sort of positions were they? Had the infantry got positions embellished with concrete?
Oh, no. It was all just dug into the sand. There was no artificial. It was all natural ground and trenches. And
so trenches and wire and...
That's right, and space.
Mines ahead of them.
That's right, yes. For the anti-tank guns.
Oh.
You know, they were sighted, so they had a good field of fire.
Looking at the infantry positions, were they in single-man rifle pits, or did they have entrenchments with more than one man in them?
think I've seen anything sort of like it. They were covered probably, what, a couple of square miles. I think these boxes might have been more. But there'd be an anti-tank gun with its crew. There'd be RA with the 25-pounders in another pit. Well spaced out, you know, in all directions, so they completely could take any attack from any direction.
All round.
All round. And as I say, there'd probably be tanks in them, anti-tank guns, and that, and probably infantry in, not in a mass, supporting each sort of weapon, as it were. Like if there were a battery or a troop of 25 pounders, there'd be infantry around to support that particular thing. They were very effective, very effective.
How close did you have to get to such a position before you could see it?
Well, so I'll sort of put the sight. I think you'd see it half a mile away, probably more, depend on how high you were. And, but most of the stuff was dug in sort of a low level, so there'd been nothing sort of stuck up to make it easy to see. Everything was sort of, the lorries were sort of dug down into pits. There was sort of the one-ton lorries with ammunition, and that sort of all sort of dug in. And of course, they'd be ideal for targets for or for aircraft. Although I think we were pretty well covered by fighter aircraft. I think we were a bit more superior, so we didn't get the attacks quite so much from the Stukas.
That's a change from earlier experience, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you were being attacked by Stukas.
That's right. Yeah.
All the time.
That's right. But now they had sort of the support. They still had they still came in, but I think we had a few more fighters up and around in order to, because our line of communication was that much shorter as well. See, so we had the Desert Air Force available.
What about anti-aircraft guns? Did you see
yes, they always had the Beaufort guns. They would be dotted in the box as well. So it was an all-round sort of brigade strength to cover
all directions
and all types of equipment.
Did you have bargain positions to take refuge in at all?
Oh, armoured car pit?
Yes.
No. No, we never did. We always just had our armoured car.
No, without getting out of it because of trouble.
Yeah. But never sort of got out of our armoured cars to seek any refuge.
But when the Brigadier went out on these visits, did he spend all day going around, or did he go back to the static location?
Oh yes, he'd probably go out for might be 4 or 5 hours, then we'd drop it, or he'd get in his jeep and he'd go, he'd leave us to go back to our squadron headquarters, and then he'd want me at a certain time again. I'd be told where to go and pick him up. on the other thing which was very interesting really was we had lots of tanks, which was the London Yeomanry, I think the 3rd and 4th.
Counting London Yeomanry.
They had their tanks there, and they were a bit to the south from where our squadron headquarters was, and you could see them, and but they were all camouflaged as lorries. And they sort of spread out, and we went over and saw them one day, and each tank had a lorry sort of Hessian and made it look as though it was a lorry going along. And I think the first sign we had was it was early morning, and it was very hot. And the sun at that time of the year was very, very hot, and the vehicles were just like red hot to touch almost. And we saw shells dropping amongst the sharpshooters, which that was the County London Yeomanry, weren't they called, the sharpshooters. And that was the first start of the Battle of Knightsbridge. And that was on the 27th of May.
How far away from them were you when this happened?
Oh. You could see the shells dropping. And some of the shells fell amongst us as well. So we were a mile, probably not that.
And this was behind the line?
Behind, they were coming behind the box, behind the minefields. And of course that was when the Germans had come round the flank. And
so they were attacking the line from the rear?
That's right. And of course, we didn't know at the time, but Bir Hakeim was really being attacked, and they destroyed dozens of German tanks at Bir Hakeim, and they kept there. They didn't move them out. They still there, and they took quite a battering. But then they came up behind or the side of the sharpshooters, and that's when they started to roll up the line from the south. And
You saw the shells falling. Mm. How long did it take before you understood what was happening?
2 minutes.
So you then realised the Germans were behind.
They were coming up from the south. Mm. And they were dropping. I mean, it wasn't the odd shell, there was quite a lot of shells dropping, you know, and so we thought, right, this is no place for us, let's move somewhere. Oh, I don't know which direction. I know we went somewhere where we thought we'd be out of range a little bit. Mm. And as I say, that was on the 27th. And there was a tremendous barrage Rommel forces were put out. And they attacked the southern flank of Bir Hakeim. And then they came, swung round, and started coming up north. So you can see it, visualize it, can't you? Going up, heading towards Gazala on the side of the lines, on the British side of the minefields. And heading towards Knightsbridge and Acroma. And Acroma was what they call it, the cauldron, where there was a tremendous sort of battle there. And that's where the main part of the fighting took place.
Did you get involved in that?
Well, I then had to take the brigadier around there the next 2 days, all during that fighting. Heavy casualties inflicted by the Free French and the Armoured Brigades and 7th Armoured Motor Brigade. We inflicted a lot of casualties, and in fact, I thought at one time we'd beaten them. Because at one stage they ran out of petrol, I think, the Germans, and we had them, if we'd have been sort of a bit more drive, I think we might have defeated them. That's what some of the people were saying. I don't know how true it was.
But
they were saying at the time we should really get them. But I know that the next 2 days I was going round the front line with Billy Carr.
What was his feeling? Did he express any views about
No, not really. No, I know he did say at one time I think we'd beaten them, but that was only just an odd remark. But whether it was just for morale or not, I don't know. But he didn't say a great deal. And
did he seem confident and optimistic?
He seemed to be. He seemed to be optimistic. You know, but one can't tell by just... they don't say... he didn't say a lot about... but all around there, it was everywhere you looked, where I was driving them, were burnt out tanks, you know, burning tanks.
Ours or enemy?
Both.
Both.
And black smoke, flames coming up, different vehicles all, you know, looked a complete, well, they call it the Devil's Cauldron, that's what it looked like. So, dust. And then the Stukas came down, all round out, it was all within that 2 days anyway. So they were bombing some of the boxes as well, and whatever they could hit. And, you know, I know the Air Force couldn't be everywhere, but it was the odd occasion when they got through that they came down and did the damage.
Did you ever see any dogfights?
Oh, yes, saw dogfights. Once or twice you would see one of the fighters shot down. I remember once there was it a Kitty Hawk, I think? Super, you saw it sort of, it was hit and it was diving and suddenly it turned up and shot straight up, and then as it got to the top to turn to come down, the pilot stepped out. It was brilliant the way it came, the plane went up like that, and then as it got to that, he jumped out and the plane came straight down. You saw him parachuting. You saw one or two dog fights and one or two shot down. But on that day, that would be the 2 days after the 27th, it was sort of an awful sight to see, the amount of tanks burning and the loss of life. Tremendous. And on the 29th, I took him round. And there were, as I say, scores of tanks, British and German, spread all over the battlefield. Cruise line dead, half in, half out of the turrets and driver's hatches. Burned, wounded, some on the ground. You know, and with the heat of the sun at that time, now what was it, did I say May?
Yes, late May.
Really hot. You know, you could hardly touch the side of the armoured cars. It was so hot. And the bodies out there, the stench. And, you know, it was an awful, awful sight. Really was. And that carried on. And say the RAF came over and bombers came in. And a number of dogfights. A number of enemy were shot down as well. All around that day. A guard brigade took everything that the enemy could give, and they didn't move, they didn't budge at all. They were fantastic. Of course, the key to Tobruk lay in the Knightsbridge box, and that was the thing they had to overcome before they could go on to Knightsbridge. But and the feeling then, at this particular stage, that Rommel was defeated, and a bold move by the commanders, and defeat him completely. But it seemed though that just bold move didn't come.
Have you no idea why it didn't happen?
Well, I'm only looking at from what our own people were saying and thought. I mean, it could have been anything. It could have been we'd lost so many tanks. Well, I think we lost 200 tanks in one day at one time, round about this area. And it could have been supply. I mean, it wasn't. You only get a small picture. You don't really know what the big picture was, but the general feeling that was that we'd won. But that was good for morale anyway. And the enemy had dropped back at this stage, but it was only to replenish and regroup, and soon they came back in again.
And presumably the second time they came back, they'd have had a much better knowledge of the position.
That's right, yeah. Yep. And they could well have destroyed a lot of our best tanks. And on the 31st, we had a dust storm. And so that was a bit more confusing for us anyway, because the enemy could move. And they could slip through without us seeing them.
Did they do that?
And they took advantage of it. I know when I was, and this was on the 31st, and the French were still holding on to Bir Hakeim, and the attacks on them were by masses of tanks and gunfire. The whole perimeter was littered with burned out wrecks and enemy armour. I went back there later and looked at it when we came up the next time, and the whole round Bir Hakeim was one mass of wrecked vehicles. You know, it was fantastic. They did a fantastic job. I can't think who the commander of the Free French was, but they did name the general who was commanding it. And three troop of the squadron attacked an enemy column and took 74 prisoners. That was C squadron, or my squadron.
What sort of enemy forces that would they have been in?
Infantry, yeah. A column, they were moving. So they were shot up, and of course the prisoners had nothing, they weren't dug in or anything like that. They were just
in
transit, yeah. And still taking the brigadier around, and all the troops were getting pretty tired because they had had a pretty tough time and not a lot of sleep. But there didn't seem to be any end. And that day, we got back to squadron headquarters, and I had the brigadier still with me, and the brigadier went to speak to my squadron leader, Bruce Shand, and somebody told me, "Oh, as a cablegram for you on the mail truck." And so that was in the echelon. The echelon was spread all over, on our mail truck anyway, with C squadron, and that was probably about a quarter mile away or something like that. Good long way. So I said, right, I'll walk over to it and get it. Leave the brigadier in squadron headquarters.
Talking to a squadron commander.
That's right. So I thought, well, I'll wander over. But I always took my mascot with me wherever I went. If I got out of the armoured car, I'd have it in my pocket.
What was your mascot?
A little crocheted thing that my sister had made of Dopey, the one of the Seven Dwarfs.
Oh, yes.
Did I not show it to you? I had it up in my office. And I always had that hanging on my guns all through the war. And so I always used to put that in my pocket. If I got out of the armoured car, it was always with me. And my haversack, which kept various things in. Always, it was automatic. You got out and you had that with you. I walked over and got my cable, and had been sent from India by my brother before he was with the Chindits, and that was before he went up into Burma. He sent me a cable, and when I came back, my car had gone.
What happened to it?
The brigadier couldn't wait for me, he'd gone off with it. So there was I stuck without a vehicle. There was a squadron jeep, so I had that. So I had to sort of say, "Oh well, I'll wait until tonight when he'll bring my car back." So apparently he went off. That's right. He went off with my car, and with the car in his jeep, and apparently the car went into a soft patch. And so he got out of it and left it, got into his jeep and said to my driver and gunner, "Oh, I'll send somebody to pull you out, and, to recover you." And off he went. But within an hour, the Germans had advanced and taken my car and the driver and the gunner prisoner. So that was it.
You lost them.
I lost him and lost the car. So,
when did you know about that?
That evening, or when we realised the enemy advanced, and the car and said he'd, you know, it'd have to send for it. And then we realised that was now in enemy hands,